Burrs. And this is my fourth time I'm chatting with him on YouTube. My first time was actually 2014. And that's a great interview. I'll link it to the video description. And then we interviewed Emmett a couple months ago and also this past weekend. I wanted to chat with Emmett because he put on a big trade, a big bet recently on the S&P 500 inclusion, betting on long, I guess, way out of the money, short-term calls expiring January 2021. And I wanted to just get an update on, you know, Emmett's situation, how he's feeling, how he's doing, if his strategy has changed, and just kind of dive into his mind. But I first want to just say that this is not investing advice at all. We don't know anyone's situation. Please don't listen to us, you know, and base your moves based off of that. And we're going to repeat that again at the end. But this is just our personal experience, you know, our personal thoughts, and it has nothing to do with any other people right now. So, Emmett, how's it going?
Good, good, good. I mean, the stock's gone in my favor a lot faster than I anticipated. So it's, you know, pretty good mood the last few days, I guess. Yeah. It feels kind of like I was telling my my wife. It feels kind of like when your team's in the Super Bowl and you put a little money on it or something, and you're rooting for that team, and you have a lot of excitement for that 3 hours. But this is going to be like maybe a month long of excitement. So it's kind of exciting. Yeah, fun.
Yeah, I mean, on Sunday night when we talked, or Saturday night, whenever it was. The stock was at like 490, right? And so you had gotten your options at 455-ish or so when the stock was down. And the option calls were about $7 each. And the past 2 days, the stock's been on a roar. And yep. I think today it closed at $555 after hours, like 562. Yeah, it's insane. When you're watching this, like, what's going through your head?
I'm thinking, you know, this is running up faster than I anticipated. And it makes me nervous a little because I feel like there's a better chance that either this move up is going to be much bigger than I even thought, which would be great, or that there's a ton of speculation driving the price up. And if I don't time it right, I could lose everything if it tanks from, you know, 700 down to like 600, you know, the third week of December or something, and doesn't come back up, you know. So I could see that happening too. So I have to, you know, as it rises really fast, I'm kind of thinking about my plan to maybe, I think I mentioned in the past that sometimes I sell, you know, a portion of my position just to make a little bit of money and then let the rest ride, kind of thing. You know, that's kind of one strategy I'm thinking of here if it keeps running up faster than I thought. I was looking at the, interestingly, I think they closed at $24 or $25 a contract today, the 700 calls that I had bought. So it's up like three times already. But I was looking, like you said, it closed around 555, 560, got up to, and I was looking at the option contracts for at the money, the 560 strike contracts, right, for January 15th. And those trade at around $65 or $70 a contract when it's at 560. So if the stock runs up to $700 in the next few days, then I could just sell out a lot of it for a 10x return, because I'm thinking that this option contract could easily get to $65 or $70 a contract too for the next like few days or week or so, which at this pace could easily happen.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is going on? Do you think it's because I was like thinking about it today. I was like, are funds buying right now? I guess there might be some, but you know, most funds, I don't think they would probably be motivated to buy necessarily early, because aren't they just indexed to the S&P 500? They're not trying to necessarily beat the S&P 500, right? I don't know what's the motivation to necessarily buy so early, but I don't know. What's your take?
Yeah. I mean, it could be a lot of speculators, but also I think more likely it's the benchmarked funds that are just trying to get ahead of the trade and just trying to get their 1% weighting it's probably going to be 1.5% weighting by the time this runs up a little more, maybe higher by that time. So they're just trying to get, I think it's the benchmarked funds, some of the early movers that are trying to get ahead and get a good price on their weighting in time for December 21st, because maybe they're anticipating there's a lot of risk if they wait themselves. And the index funds still have to buy. I don't think the index funds can buy until December. And I'm very curious what the S&P is going to come out with. I think November 30th with their what they recommend or what you know they've been advised to do on the two-part rebalancing, right? They were going to do like 50-50 or 25-75 or something. So I'm very curious to see what they come out with on November 30th with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember I replied to one of your tweets. I'm like, you know, why don't you, you know, sell a third or so, right? After three X's and then let the rest of the two thirds ride, you know, with your bet. So you can at least take your cost basis out. So what are your thoughts? I'm guessing you're probably thinking maybe it's too early. That's my guess right now. It just started, right?
So it just started too early. I feel like the fireworks haven't even started yet, to be honest. Like, but they have in a way, but I feel like really it hasn't because it's still just a few days in. And I think there's a lot of buying left to be done. Like this is unlike any other catalyst. Like I keep reminding myself, like, people talk about catalysts, you know, like what's the next catalyst for Tesla? Is it the Q3 numbers or the profit margin or the new product, the battery day? Is that a catalyst for the stock price? It's a catalyst for the company, but the actual share price, it's not necessarily a catalyst, right? What's a catalyst is this, you know, marching order from the S&P committee that these 5 trillion of index funds, they have to buy 1.2% or more now of Tesla in their portfolios. I mean, that's a huge, like 120 million shares. They have to buy that. They have no questions. They have to do it. You know, that's a catalyst in my mind. And so I just don't think that's been accounted for very well in speculators even yet. So I think it could run up a lot more still, you know, and I want to keep a large portion on the table for that potential possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got it. It's interesting. I guess will you reevaluate? I guess every day you're reevaluating in a sense, right? Getting more information.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of great people on Twitter, you know, that, you know, I think a lot of us follow. There's like a guy has been communicating, Frank Pelton, or the guy Gary Black, he puts information out there, another Tesla Facts or something. You know, there's all these great people on Twitter that put all this great information together about the S&P 500 inclusion and stats, and you just kind of gather more data from all points of view to try to figure out what the best decision is going forward. I mean, what do you think? Do you think the stock's going to keep running up, Dave? I mean, you're a little more conservative than me, so I'm curious. What's your opinion?
I mean, I actually. So what I did was I wrote out a grid, and so the day, the evening of the S&P 500 inclusion after they announced it, I'm like, okay, so what are the chances? How am I viewing this probability wise? So I said, okay, the chances that the stock ends up between $400 to $500, let's say by, you know, December 21st or so, versus 500 to 600, and then versus like 600 and up. And so I said, okay, those are maybe three major scenarios. And I jotted down my scenarios, and I tend to be a little conservative on those. And so I said, okay, let's change it and let's have another column for bull case, you know, for if I was more enthusiastic, how much could I give with those percentages? And, you know, I think in both of my scenarios, I figured there'd be like, you know, 50% chance that, or higher, that S&P 500 would be above 550. In my bull case, it was like 50% chance it'd be above 600 actually, by December 21st. So I was quite bullish. I just, for me, the only,
you didn't think it would be November 21st. You didn't think it would be
exactly.
December 21st.
December 21st. That's one thing. But, the other thing was, it's like the jump from, I say, because the stock was at like 400 or so, you know, before the S&P 500 inclusion. So for it to jump 50% up to 600, that's actually a big jump. But then to go from 400 to like 700 or 800, that's like double of a company that's already 10x. So for me, probabilities go down significantly after 650, 700, you know. It just, the greatest probabilities in my opinion was like from the 550 up and 600 up. I could see that being like very realistic. But yeah, I think definitely, you know, your
probabilities are higher. Are you updating your probability table today or every day, or are you
I'm
going
actually
to stick
keeping
with it?
it. I'm actually keeping it
Okay.
because I don't want to get kind of caught up in the hype of like, oh,
Yeah.
because the stock price is up, I'm going to up my probabilities. I kind of want to stick with the probabilities that I kept, from the beginning
Sure.
personally.
Yeah. It's fair. Yeah. Okay. What if the stock gets to like $700 in 2 weeks? Like, then you'd probably have to reset your probability table from that point forward,
Well,
right?
yeah, I mean, it's like tearing it apart,
Well, I mean, you should just update. I mean, what's interesting is the firm I used to work at, or they work, Interactive Brokers, they have this cool tool called the Probability Lab. And so you can actually do what you're saying and like put your probabilities that you think and put it on this like chart, and then it tells you what the options are pricing in as the probabilities, and then you can kind of see like where your difference is, and then it can even suggest trades for you and stuff. Like, it's interesting. It's unique to Interactive Brokers, but it got me think when I first came out with that tool, I think they it got me thinking differently about options,
Yeah.
just
Have
and
you heard of the
probabilities.
Kelly criterion?
No,
Oh,
what's
okay.
the
Yeah.
Kelly
It's a
criterion?
fascinating kind of calculation and formula that it's a betting formula basically, right? And if you basically assess certain probabilities that you see of a situation, it'll basically tell you what percent of your kind of money to put into that bet to maximize, right? Both the potential and minimize the risk. But yeah, it's pretty fascinating. Some people actually invest off of that stuff, like actually put in probabilities. I think it's a little bit complex, but I think the point of it though is if there comes kind of a major opportunity that you have a super high conviction in, then the Kelly criterion actually shows that you should put in something into the bet, especially if you think it's going to be a huge outcome, let's say a 5x or 10x in whatever period of time. And it just makes mathematical sense, if you if you're thinking like, and you could be wrong, of course, your probability. So you could obviously lose everything because you misjudge the probabilities in some senses. But let's say you thought you had a 60% chance of it going up to 700 or something, the stock price, and it was going to be a 10x or something in your investment, then the Kelly criterion would basically the formula, the mathematical formula would actually show you that you should actually put in a certain percent into that bet. Because it's the rewards are so high, that the
Okay.
outcome will justify it. Even though you'll
Sure.
lose some bets along the way, when you win the bet, right, you win a much greater amount.
Oh, so sort of like what I'm doing,
Yeah,
but it's
exactly.
someone kind of created an actual formal process for
Yeah,
formula.
yeah, yeah. Check out some YouTube videos on Kelly Criterion. There's some good ones out
Okay.
there, and yeah, it's actually you're probably doing it more intuitively. You kind of
Yeah.
intuitively know that if you have super high conviction on a super high reward bet, and you might lose some, but if you lose some just with a certain smaller percentage, then you'll still be alive, to bet again. And
Yeah.
once you bet, you make the 10x or 20x or 50x or whatever, that will, outweigh your losses probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious. There are some people who are asking, like, if Tesla kind of jumps super high, 700, 800. See, I'm kind of hesitant to even think about like Tesla going into 900. Most of the time it doesn't happen. That's the thing. And people get all emotional and all that stuff,
Yeah.
hoping it'll happen. And it's like wishful thinking, right? But nevertheless, if it does jump super high, what's your take on kind of like selling puts or selling out or kind of reversing your position? Because do you see I guess someone was saying, do you think Tesla, if it went super high, would the S&P 500 inclusion event be a possible sell on the news event, right?
Yeah,
That you could play the
yeah.
other side. What's your thoughts?
I mean, I think there is some sell in the news, just from speculators who are jumping in, getting ready to sell their shares to the S&P index funds. But that's 120 million shares. I mean, that's a lot of shares for speculators to be buying up to sell back, So I think in other index inclusion events, that's probably happens a lot where you have the niche, strategies where they dedicate a certain amount of capital to doing exactly that. But to have, 60 or 70 billion worth of cash sitting around collectively, I don't think that's as realistic for Tesla versus some of the other events that are probably much, a tenth of the size, if even that. I don't know. Facebook was pretty big, but I don't recall how big it was. But I also think that, the S&P funds that buy Tesla stock, they're not selling it, right? So it's sort of like a buffer. So it might get to a certain price and kind of stick there for a while. I'm not sure it'll be like a violent down move. It could be, but I'm hoping because it's not just some normal catalyst where it's, pure, speculation. This is a little different, as I mentioned earlier, where they're actually have to buy. They basically have to take 120 million shares out of circulation, plus the benchmark funds. And a lot of those benchmark funds never even touched Tesla before because it was too speculative, too crazy of a business model for them to have an opinion on, right? So now they have to have an opinion on it, and they either have to buy it or decide actively not to include it in their portfolio, which includes probably 499 other S&P 500 stocks, So I think it's just a huge tsunami of buying, taking shares out of circulation, and it could just go up a lot, but maybe it's priced in at this point even, and it just kind of goes back and forth between. I wouldn't be surprised if it just sticks between like 500 and 600. That could happen too. So it's risky, and also like we talked about in the last one, a lot of it depends on the macro markets. Like the markets are doing. The growth stocks in general have been doing very well, and what if interest rates, someone thinks they're going to go up, and then everyone gets out of growth and goes back to value stocks, like and so there's a lot of risk. Anyway, I'm not sure if that answered the question, but it could pull back violently, or it could kind of stay stable at wherever it goes, 800, 900, or 1,000, or 600.
One of the reasons why, I'm comfortable kind of chatting with you regarding options and all this stuff and betting is, first off, I've known you for quite a long time, and I've seen kind of the whole ups and downs over the years and gotten to know you. But I also have seen a lot of mistakes or a lot of losses that you've incurred because of I wouldn't say miscalculated, but there's no way you can accurately know the future, especially short term future,
That's right.
and there are over the years I've seen you hit it out of the ballpark sometimes with big moves, but I've also seen you kind of lose a decent amount, right? And it's not so much that you have per se amazing abilities to accurately predict the future. I don't think that's the I think some people might be watching like, oh, what is Emmett going to do next? I'm going to just follow whatever. And I think that's going to just kill people in terms of their portfolio or bets, because the thing that I think you have isn't necessarily you're super accurate in predicting the future, but there comes along these what I call super moves. And it feels like it seems like that's where you've made the most in your kind of history of investing and trading, is these crazy super moves that just totally just go beyond, explanation in a way. And those gains have outshadowed all your other losses, I don't know, when I look at your other bets, just the non-super move bets, I don't think you're that great of a trader per se, or better. I think you could just be very just average or very
I'm
mediocre
average,
or
maybe,
something. It wouldn't be fantastic returns. I think people might be shocked to be like, what is this, But it's these few super moves, that jumped, let's say, your initial portfolio from tens of thousands to, let's say, a few million, right, several years ago, back in 2012 to 14.
13.
And then this past year, kind of the super move is, and most of your move was most of your portfolio was in Tesla, like leaps, right? That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, mostly Tesla leaps and shares, a combination. I always wanted to have this core shares I wouldn't touch in my personal account, but I speculated as much as possible and everything else with deep in the money long-term leaps for years, And they were the kill, You're right. I mean, I had a nice super move with the Tesla stock, but I also got a super move on the downward this year with the COVID crash, and then I got back in at the right time. So I got very lucky this past year. I always thought in the back of my head, like, man, if you could just time one down big down move in the market you'll be golden. You know, like just once, just time the down. No one times the down moves and the up moves, you know. But I'm always a bull on the market in general. It goes up, what, 6% a year now, 8% a year on average over the long term. You know, so you always have to be sort of bullish on the market in general, I think. But, you know, it does take these magnanimous drops sometimes. And if you could just get one of those right, it could be all the difference. But you can't try to do it all the time or you'll just lose out, right? So you have to just
Exactly.
get it right. And so I got it right this year and it was great,
Yeah.
you know.
And the thing is, like, there aren't that many super moves, you know, that are predictable in some ways, you know, that have, like, there are super moves in different stocks, you know, especially this year with COVID and, you know, everything's just shot up. But yeah, it's fascinating. I wanted to ask you about, so you sent me some screenshots of your account over the weekend, and one of the things that stuck out is, like, what most people won't realize just with our last interview, is that most of your holdings are in Tesla stock, right? And also deep in the money leaps. And so, what we have right now is, from your account, I looked, you have like about 40,000 Tesla shares, right? So this is just common stock. And at today's close of 5:50 or so, it's about $22 million worth of Tesla shares. And then you've got 765 deep in the money option or leaps, long dated, right? Option calls. And these range from, actually, I'll just list them in case some people actually know what these are. It's June 2020 to 270 calls, June 21 160 strike. Oh, sorry, 270 strike. Then June 21 160 strike. January 22 170 strike. June 21 160 strike. And January 22 170 strike. So the average of all of this stuff is about a 200 strike deep in the money call. That's about a year out. That's like the average you have, you know. So I looked up this stuff, and most of your calls are worth about $400 each. And so for 675 contracts, that controls 67,500 shares, which basically makes your deep in the money leap position about worth about 25 million. So if you combine 22 plus 25, you have about 47 million in shares, or pretty much like share equivalent. Right. And then your other stuff is, I mean, you don't have a ton of, you have some other positions in your LLC, but it's more minor. And then you've got now this, you know, $2.7 million bet, short term that you're writing. But what most people don't
But
realize
just to be
is,
clear, most of that $2.7 million is not in the fund. It's mostly my personal account. I have a small in the fund. It's a little more diversified, as you said. I have like a big Square position, but it's also Tesla is like 65% of that portfolio, but not 95%.
So
Anyway.
what's happening is you've got right now 47 million in longer term, right, Tesla holdings, because you're a long term, and in some ways you're more of a long term investor in that sense, you know,
Absolutely.
than this
Yeah,
short term trader.
absolutely.
But
Yeah, I'm not a short-term gambler. Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
but you've used that in a way to increase your exposure to Tesla. How did you get those 40,000 shares? Like, were you holding them the whole time, or did you like exercise, you know, options, or what happened?
Yeah, good question. So I think if you remember 2000, if people watched the earlier interview from 2013, I think, or 2014, from that run up, I got a lot of great options deep that turned into be deep in the money options. And I exercised, or I took assignment of most of those call options that were deep in the money. And I sold a little bit of it, but I took assignment. So I hold a lot of my shares. I think, you know, a lot of the shares are long term held, but then also when the market crashed in February or March, early April, I sold a bunch of Tesla on the way down. You know, I kept, you know, I think I kept like 10,000 shares or equivalent to 2,000 shares now, long term, maybe more, since 2013. But the rest I like sold long, and I was had some cash on the sidelines waiting for the market to kind of stabilize. And once I thought it did, I bought a whole bunch of shares back too, around. At that time, it was $420 before the split. So what's that? $84, I think. So, you know, I bought a whole bunch of new shares before the market came really back up. And then I also bought those. I think they were the 1350 calls. You know, the stock was only like $500, but I bought a whole bunch of 1350 strike call options at that time, the June 2022, I think, because that was the furthest out expiry you could go. And that's the two like 75 or something call options you listed there, strike. And so most of my shares I bought pre-split, obviously, and they've split to be 40,000 long-term shares now. Yeah. And I plan on just holding those long term, and even the deep in the money calls, I'll let those expire and be assigned a lot of those shares and just hold them. I know some people are asking, like, oh, what do you mentioned something about selling deep out of the money covered calls. And yeah, I mean, that's something you can do to generate income, right? So I'm thinking of holding the long term shares and just selling way deep out of the money calls after I feel like the dust settles from this S&P inclusion event.
Got it. Will you try to like eventually think exercise most of your deep in the money calls, or will you sell some to raise cash
Yeah.
and exercise some?
It'll be a combination. I don't like to have margin balances. I used to have that a lot, and it was extra nerve-wracking going to bed at night when you have those margin balances and you're worried about, the next flash crash or whatever, and you could get called and stuff. So yeah, I'm gonna do a combination so that I can hold as many shares as possible, pay taxes on the gains that I had to sell to hold the shares fully paid for. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah, I remember I took on some margin to exercise some leaps back, like this was in 2014, 15. Leaps I'd bought like early in 2013. And it wasn't like a big percentage of my overall portfolio per se, the margin, but it was just like this mental drain. Just
Yeah.
like because I'm always keenly aware of risk, you know, and I'm keenly aware that nothing is guaranteed either. And like lots can happen, you know, like things can go to zero, you know, it's happened
Yeah.
before. And I'm keenly aware that debt usually isn't, you know, wiped out very easily.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, those are a stressful couple of years. I'm glad I paid it off as quick as possible. And I'm glad I went through it just because it was something that I don't think it was high risk because it was a small percent of my overall portfolio, but it allowed me to gain a lot more shares because, you know, I didn't need to pay taxes. Yeah, so, but yeah, I
How
mean,
long did it take you to pay off that margin debt? Was it like
man,
a 1 year process or a
no, it
multi-year?
took me like probably about 2 years or two and a half. Like I remember after I paid that off, I
You
was
felt
just
good.
like, oh my gosh, it was like it was the happiest day because I'm like,
Yeah.
we're done, you know? I'm like,
Yeah.
no more margin, like, and yeah, I mean, it was one of those moves where it's like I actually by doing the whole margin thing, I ended up with probably a good like 25 to 30% more shares than I would have, you know, if I didn't exercise just because of all
Yeah.
the benefits. And it was worth it, but man, the psychological weight of it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah. Psychological weight
I
of
hear.
success. It's like you do so well, you have to get all these shares and margin, and then you have to figure out what to do with the margin, right? Or the taxes now. What do you do with the taxes? So
Exactly.
it's just. And one other thing I wanted to mention is that I think about a lot is I think what's worked with Tesla, like we've seen, is like these long-term leaps. And you see so many people doing that now. And I feel that the market, while history repeats itself, I don't think the market's reaction repeats itself to things. And to me, that means kind of like, okay, the leaps worked for a while, but they may not work anymore. Like you can't just keep, just because it worked the last 5 years or part of the last, for 5 years it didn't work actually, from 2014 to 2019, but just because it worked in 2012, 2014, and 2019 to 2021 does not mean it's going to work ever again, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
So I think that's a very real possibility. Yeah, I have all these people messaging me and saying, like, I do the leaps now, I love it, I love it. And it's great if you've already had success, but the people just jumping into that now, be very wary. I mean, this stuff doesn't, these opportunities don't keep going. They're not like the market adjusts, like somehow magically these things don't, like you have to adjust to the market. The market doesn't adjust to your strategy.
I mean, it's like,
Or vice versa, sorry.
yeah, a lot of times, like the super move happens because it was like being brewed for many, many years, you know? Like, for
Yeah.
example, there was, you know, I think a big suppression or, you know, with Tesla, with media and shorts and all this stuff, but also some mishaps on Tesla's ramping of Model 3 production. But there's so many things that contributed to this 5-year, you know, lag and suppression. And, you know, there were so many different catalysts at one time, you know, with becoming profitable, with, you know, Model 3, Model Y ramp, with Shanghai and expansion, now with S&P 500, all just like in 1 year, you know, just all came, and you just saw this, the top blow off. And not just that, it's COVID too. You know, it's like COVID revalued everything and reshaped everything. And to have all of those things come together again, you know, within the next few years, it's like the chances are very, very low. Like,
there's not much more that can happen all at the same time.
Exactly. Like, for folks who are like, are doing these, like, you know, bold, you know, like leaps, you know, way out there. It's like, yeah, man, it's
even like the 800, like people who are buying like 700 leaps. Like, I still think that's even, that's risky too, because like this S&P inclusion, the stock could run up to like 1,000, but then who knows, maybe the whole market's kind of like in a lull for 4 years or 3 years. Exactly. And it kind of like dwindles and the stock kind of fluctuates between $600 and $800, and your leaps you just paid a fortune for now turn to be worthless over 2 years, you know? So I think buying the stock is the safest, the right thing. That's what I tell people to do that are, you know, not sure what to do. Like, if you can't come to your own conclusion of what to do by yourself, like, you really need to just not do something risky.
Yeah, exactly. I wrote a blog post on like, or a post on my mega thread at TMC, like back in 2014 or 15 or so. And I was talking about, you know, how to use leaps as a way to, you know, expand your exposure to Tesla. And the whole theory was, you know, you hold stock when the stock price is pretty much like medium high and high, you know, medium to high, you hold stock. But if the stock price is basically medium to low or really low, then you start converting to leaps, you know, more.
Yeah.
And then over time, if the stock price rises, then you do the reverse, you know. If it's kind of high, you revert back and you just buy all kind of shares. And when I think about that, it makes sense on, but there's a few things that need to happen. First, you need to accurately kind of assess whether a stock price is high or low, you know. That's hard for most people. But then another thing that throws it off is the lows could be actually super prolonged, you know, just like how it was with Tesla. And you can actually run out of hope or run out of like perseverance and just end up closing everything because you're just almost like wiped out right before the spike up. And so it's like, whoever, like, it's just, I don't know. It's, there's reason for the reward too, because there are definitely risks involved, I think.
Yeah. It's funny because, I was doing something like that for, you know, leading up to 2020, and at the end of 2019, this is an example of a bad trade I did that I kicked myself. Well, I mean, I can't kick myself now, but for a while I was kicking myself in January of this year because I had a whole bunch of Tesla 450 strike call options, or 400, I think 400 call options or something, right? And I had like, I don't know, hundreds of them in my, and they were almost worthless by the end of 2019 because the Tesla had been like, hadn't gone above like 300. I think it was in the fall, October, November. And I was getting nervous because I had some gains from earlier in the year I'd recognized, and I wanted to be tax efficient and create some losses because I bought all those for X amount of money and I was like down, you know, 100 grand or whatever. And I wanted to just cancel out my gains with it. So I was like, I should sell these now because I've seen options get so worthless where you can't even sell it. There's no bidder. It's like zero by 1 cent as an offer, 2 cents as an offer, but no bid, and you can't sell it to anyone. So you're just stuck with it until January, the next tax year. And I would be able to cross. So I was like, I should just sell these now for like 5 or 10 cents and, or 20, whatever they were, a dollar or something, before I forget about it. And so I sold all of them. And then sure enough, it's like right before, you know, Tesla, it was right after the Cybertruck unveil or something, I think, and the Tesla's tanked, or maybe it was a month or two before, but I think it was after. And then the stock starts roaring back, and it turns out I would have made like a ton if I just held on to those through the end of January instead of like trying to be tax efficient. So sometimes trying to be tax efficient can screw you up too. And I've made some bad trades trying to be overly tax efficient too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely some interesting stuff. I want to ask about risk. Do you think like overall you'll still take a lot of risk, or do you think that will change a little bit because like will preservation come into the picture a bit, or will you kind of still kind of hold your kind of pushing forward?
I think I have a pretty good formula where I keep a certain percentage in safe long-term Tesla and a certain percentage in cash or diversified other things like real estate or whatever. But then I think a good chunk of my portfolio, it's worked for me. I'm going to put it into my fund and just try to grow the fund and do the charitable intent thing. And if it's very successful, that'd be great. So that's kind of where I'm going to try to use my skill set to see if it can, serve a greater good of some sort, not just, making money for myself, which is great, but also try to do some other stuff with that profit as well, obviously for myself, but also in spur the charitable kind of business model with the fund.
Yeah, I noticed like at a certain point, it's like the motivation to have massive gains, it's like it kind of ch needs to change or morph in some ways, you know? Because it's like after a certain net worth, it's like past that, it's like what's the point for yourself in a sense, you know? Like it's like I don't know. I guess people have different tastes as well, you know? Maybe some people
I
want the
keep thinking to that quote. I think Elon Musk said in one of the interviews recently with Third Row or something, where he said, money is just an information system for the allocation of labor. And that just got me thinking differently about things, because it was right around the time I was doing really well and I was struggling with what do I want to do? My net worth has gone up. Like, this isn't as interesting to me. And I just realized, that makes sense. Like, if I have enough, I can allocate labor to good charities, or, I could give for good causes, because I think our tax dollars are very inefficiently used, but instead it's like taxing myself, but in a way that's much more efficiently used to the greater good of society in ways I think that's important,
Yeah, like early on, like this was like probably like maybe before I invested in Tesla, I had this realization of like the way people perceive money or understand money is like very distorted and flawed. There's a lot of baggage with it. And I came up with this concept of like unit. And I said, okay, let's redefine money completely and then say, okay, what if one unit is what an average worker, let's say, can make their entire life and of savings and retirement. And I mean, there could be different, you know, values of that. Maybe it's 500,000, maybe it's a million. So let's say hypothetically it's $1 million, you know. And if we call that one unit, it's basically and let's say that one unit can hypothetically kind of feed and support, let's say, a family for 20 years or 30 years, you know. And so the question is like how many units do you need kind of for yourself, but also how many units kind of and this is kind of a little bit philosophical in a way, but I do think that certain people might have greater responsibility toward, you know, let's say making more units and then using those units for good purposes, right? So I had this early on kind of epiphany where I'm like, okay, in terms of number of units, how many units do, let's say, do I need for myself or my family? And then how many units do you think, you know, I could create for and use for good for others? You know, is it 5 units or 10 units? Is it 50 units or 100 units? And actually, I got this realization. I'm like, I think actually, due to certain kind of skill sets and also the way I look at things, that I was supposed to raise quite a few units, you know? And that's kind of helped me to invest in Tesla and to seek out opportunities, is that realization that, yeah, it really is, it's like, money and dollars, in a sense, doesn't mean much. It's the units, and the units can be transferred into either labor, like you hire people or something, or into goods, like materials, right? And some goods are actually a combination of labor and raw materials together. But yeah, with that, I started to think like at a certain point, you have too many units for yourself in a way, you know? And then it shifts to how many units will you kind of create for a certain a greater good, a greater purpose, you know? I think I'm curious just like how you will handle that transition as well, you know, to kind of creating units for others.
I think you thought of a great framework to think of it as. I mean, you get so much at a certain point, you have to think about something more than yourself to spend it on, right? And early on in people's lives. You're just trying to survive and become self-sufficient, right? And just pay for your rent and all this stuff. And at some point, you have to kind of change your mindset and try to serve some greater good. The question is, what is the greater good, right? Like, one person's greater good might be another's evil, right? So it can get tricky quick, so that's another philosophical question, that is to tackle. But yeah, I like the way you were thinking about it. Yeah. And another example of separating it to units, just like I like to play poker, for example. You're familiar with poker and Texas Hold'em. I think a lot of people are, probably now it's become popular. So I used to go to the casino, 5, 10 years ago playing, and I'd think, oh, I'm losing nuts. I can't bet that. That's too much money. I can't bet this or that, And then when I changed my mindset to say, okay, I'm bringing, $300 to the table. I expect to lose it. This is not money. This is just chips on a game, And I convinced myself to think of it that way, but a serious game, a serious game I wanted to win, because I'm competitive. Then once I thought of it that way, I was able to like do much better, not lose, and I won most of a lot of times, and I came up with like unorthodox, strategy. Like, there's so many assumptions in life and how games are played and the investments are made. Investing is just like a big game. I love it because it's like a huge game, in a way. Like, you're just trying to find the companies that are going to do the best, and it's sort of like capitalism and Darwinism combined, and so with poker, I just was like, oh, what are the assumptions that people just do? And like, for example, everyone mucks their hand. Like, all good poker players just muck their hand when they lose. Even if they're caught bluffing, they don't want to show anyone, right? No, nope, I don't want anyone to have that information. I just started doing the opposite and said, I'm going to show every hand I do, even when I bluff and I fail. I'm going to show everyone everything on the table. And I'm the only one at the table that does that. It does great. Like, I'll play, and if I get the right set of combination of hands, people know I bluff, for example, and then I get a really good hand, everyone sticks in, I can maximize the pot I get, and I end up getting like 10x the money I start with, like half the time I play. It's like, because I get the right order of like, all right, I bluffed a few times, I failed, but everyone knows, and then I got the great big hand, and everyone thinks I'm bluffing still, or vice versa. It's just, if you get the, it's just like an unorthodox strategy that people just think. Don't even think of, because they just go off what's assumed everyone else is doing, But that applies to investing and in life in general. Just, there's so many assumptions we operate on that if people can wake up to kind of, see what's an assumption versus what's a choice, they can kind of try things out differently.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to actually to talk to you about this concept of like herd mentality, and I saw your tweet, kind of, which is interesting. Like, you give your framework kind of for finding opportunity and questioning kind of the assumptions of the crowd and seeing if you can, if your own kind of conclusions are vastly different, and then trying to take action off of that. But I've been actually talking about this stuff with my wife for the past few days, kind of your tweet, but also kind of some of my own kind of philosophies and the stuff. But what I want to do is perhaps save that for another episode. Because I think actually it's I love talking about kind of a different take on stuff. I think like typically like investing has been taken over by kind of this, I don't know what it is. It's been taken over by tradition and by institutions and by just a culture of investing that, like, if I was to go into investing and then if I was a newbie to investing and then I just pick up, investing books or the typical YouTube channel or whatever, I think I would be really discouraged because it's just like, it just seems so like boxed in, it seems so predictable slash, you just need to follow what, everyone's doing and, have your so-called, 20 diversified stocks or do an index fund or do something. And like, the vision of investing is just so, in a way, not just tamed down, but it just doesn't feel like the investing that I personally know, like that I've kind of developed on my own kind of philosophies, I feel like in a lot of ways, like the essence of investing, like there's this concept of finding the pearl of great price, kind of risking it all. Like, there's a lot of like different concepts that modern day investing just has rejected in a sense, you know. But I think there's something about investing that if you don't, if you kind of remove yourself from all of the traditional kind of investing influences and the history of investors, whatever, and remove all the titles and pedigrees and experience everyone has, and you, if you can kind of be open to a new form of investing, a new look, a new value, there's actually so much potential, you know. Yeah, I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think it feels, you know, what, you know, I feel like you and I are both on the same level in that we both feel a little alien to traditional investing dogma, or maybe it's not dogma, but that's what we kind of think of it as probably. But, you know, diversification, you know, 60-40 equities, bonds, like who's doing that now, right? I mean, is that working for people? I don't know. It's just, I feel like there's all these books written, there's classic, you know, training portfolio analysis, you know, there's, it's just a lot of old money using tradition to kind of overrule new ideas, I think. And that it just seems like there's time for a new age of investing, and it doesn't have to be risky either. But anything outside of the box of what the tradition is automatically labeled as risky, right? Too risky. Oh, no, don't do that. That's too risky. You know, like you got to be diversified. This is what you got to do, you know? So I think it's important to kind of test the boundaries and try to wake up from all those assumptions. Doesn't mean you should, you know, it's a fine line between doing something really crazy, like putting your life savings down on some like call option that's going to expire worthless. Like the options I have right now, this trade I put on could very well expire worthless. You know, send the money, the price is going up, it's off to a good start, but it's probably still greater than 50% chance in my mind that it's going to expire worthless. It's not, maybe it's 30% now, but it's still greater than, it's not better than 50%. So people, I think, can get ahead of themselves and try to like get too risky or gambling, like, and they have to be careful. But I think the normal models need to be challenged, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, on the flip side, I feel like there's a lot of herd mentality in not just the preservation side, let's say just purely index or, you know, bonds or, you know, all of that. But there's also a lot of herd mentality in the betting side of things, kind of the short-term side of things, where it's like people will just flock to anything that, you know, anyone says has potential, and they don't even like look into things, you know, like,
I look into that, like I use that as an internal like measuring stick almost. Like if I start noticing people on CNBC or Bloomberg or all over Twitter saying Tesla's a great bet at this price, buy it, then I'm like, oh crap, I should probably think about getting out soon, because everyone's getting, or like when we're running up the election, everyone's like, the market's going to crash with the election. Who knows what's going to happen? Buy puts, get ready. You know, I felt like that was a crowded trade, and the market did kind of, you know, go sideways or down a little bit for a couple months before the election. But what happens right after? Well, everyone has to unwind their, you know, cash on the sidelines and put it back into equities, or, you know, it just, the market goes back up. It wasn't a big event. So a lot of times it's just trying to identify what the herd is and then steering clear of it. And, you know, sometimes the herd can be right, you know,
yeah,
too.
Definitely.
It's not always wrong, but you just have to kind of think about it for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a lot of things, a lot of interesting stuff to think about. All right, Emmett, I want to let you go here, but thank you for chatting again. And yeah, I appreciate it. I love chatting about stuff like this. You know, I feel like not enough people talk about kind of like investing on a kind of two levels down, you know, kind of like,
it's philosophical. Yeah. Psychological.
I feel like too much of it is just like,
aren't talked about.
Yeah. I feel like it's just all on the shallow level, and
it's all quantitative and spreadsheet based. And I think that's a weakness these days. I think too many people do that. I think that time will come again eventually, like things go in cycles. Right. And maybe there'll be a time and place for that one day again, but right now it just doesn't seem to be working so well for people.
All right, man. Take care.
All right.
And we'll chat again. And I'll add Emmett's Twitter account on the video description. I'll add his website and the past interviews I've done with Emmett. And if you have any other questions for Emmett, add them in the comment section. I'll try to, you know, have Emmett on again to update the trade, but also maybe talk about some other aspects and angles on investing.
Yeah. All right. And this is just our experience, just so everyone reminding everyone, it's just our experience. If they missed the beginning, this is not, none of this is investment advice, right? It's just our own experience we're talking about with each other. And we just have to make sure people, that's clear. Some people are asking us constantly for what trade should I do? Which trade should I do? And we can't tell people what to do. It's just our own experience we're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, people actually have pretty much stopped asking me about, because I keep on telling people, like, I'm not telling you, like, you know, think for yourself. Like, hey, I have a disclaimer on every one of my video descriptions about, hey, this is, you know, not financial advice, you know, make your own decisions. That's good. Very clear. But
yeah, that's smart.
All right, man.
Okay.
Cool. Okay. Thanks. We'll talk later. All right. Bye.